Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. I've heard it often in talking with people about Eastern Kentucky's economic future. We need a new and better narrative, they say. And as one who grew up in Eastern Kentucky and went off to discover the ways of the world in places like Washington and New York City, I can testify that the narrative that seems to cling to us wherever we go is not always a happy one. I won't go into it now. You know what I'm talking about. So what about that news story and its connection with another thing we often hear about a post-coal option for the region, tourism? How do we find just the right balance between realities and attractiveness? Joining us to talk about that is folklorist Mary Hufford, visiting professor of folklore at Ohio State University in Columbus and associate director of the Livelihoods Knowledge Exchange Network in Lexington. She is former director of the Center for Folklore and Ethnography at the University of Pennsylvania and served for 20 years as a folklife specialist in the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. Thanks for joining us, Mary.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's begin by exploring something in Chapter 2 of Conserving Culture. It's a collection of contributed chapters which you edited. James Abrams, a fellow folklorist who has worked on industrial heritage projects in southwestern Pennsylvania, notes that the social and cultural terrain of everyday life appears progressively more disjointed and ruptured. And it's what he goes on to say in that paragraph that I think really applies to where we are today. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Oh, I'd love to. Parts of this paragraph by my wonderfully creative colleague, Jim Abrams, are in many ways even more applicable now than 30 years ago when Conserving Culture was published. He writes about the wounds inflicted by capital flight, deindustrialization, outmigration of the region's children, the declining significance of big union politics, and now, I would add, climate change and the pandemic, the face masks we wear, the squares confining us during Zoom calls. These all also symbolize what I'm coming to experience as the pixelation of reality. Reality is more disjointed and ruptured in many ways now. In another respect, we've moved beyond the approach to heritage planning, of which Jim is very critical when he says these wounds were setting the stage for cultural repair workers. I remember there was a good bit of protest around Pittsburgh at the time of the plant closings. One of the protest signs said, "The rich get richer and the poor get heritage." Heritage, in that respect, was static, sealing its actors into a world that is finished. Over the last three decades, there's been a good bit of stage resetting to bring cultural strengths to bear on both economic revitalization and ecological restoration. So as this book was being published, in fact, we were already moving away from research and planning paradigms that place decision-making in the hands of expert planners to move to more community-based participatory action models, wherein communities get to decide what their cultural assets are and are provided with access to the kinds of expertise that can help identify those assets and to understand the implications of different pathways to development. I think of the experts who work in this sphere as place workers. As a folklorist, I bring to place work an appreciation for the myriad ways in which communities express and celebrate themselves, particularly in relation to the diverse watersheds and forest species of Central Appalachia. The stories of how people came here, how things got their names, how to make a living on the land are as richly variegated as the land itself, which in many ways provides continuity against this experience of historical rupture that Jim Abrams is writing about.
Turning to another chapter in this book, and maybe 30 years since it was published, but a lot of it is very applicable to where we are today. And in another chapter, University of Maryland anthropologist Hervé Chambers talks about how tourism can transform human and environmental resources into specific kinds of commodities and turn a significant community ritual, let's say, into a tourist attraction. Why is it important to recognize this possibility and the possible dangers of it as we talk about developing a tourism industry for Eastern Kentucky?
Well, I think it is important to think about alternatives to this approach. which people have been working on and thinking about quite a bit since Conserving Culture was published. I find that when I'm listening, people are often curious to know what I think. And it's really because I represent another point of view from which communities might imagine themselves. So community life in the Appalachian region, as you mentioned in your beginning here, is often presented to larger than local publics through a very distorted lens. So place work is about cultivating identity through genuine identity work. It works the way it works in a conversation between two people, which regardless of what the topic is, will also be about the relationship between the speakers. And part of that work has to do with affirming that you are hearing, seeing, and understanding what the other speaker is saying to you. The question then becomes, how can tourism be a site for scaling up that process? Because that's where identity work can happen. So fully engaging communities in the process of self-presentation allows for that growth of relationships between communities and guests. How does that happen? I say, make that engagement a focus of planning for cultural and ecotourism in the region. Invite communities to propose plans for hosting visitors, including eateries, forest trails, Airbnbs, historic sites, wide range of local events, and provide funding for implementation and also for consultation with place workers. Develop trails across the region, connecting these sites along many vectors: forest foods, industrial history, Afro-Latin culture and history, Appalachian Indians of West Virginia culture and history, and also agroforestry. In Japan, there is something called the Satoyama. These are the peasant forests, and these are also tourist destinations. The forests of central Appalachia have a long and deep history that would be a lovely way to engage guests and would be engaging around the kinds of things that people love and are proud of, this relationship to the land. In every community I've been in over the last 30 years, I've encountered incredible examples of what we might call cultural impresarios, people in the community who are already positioned between the inside and the outside and who are stewarding and caring for community members, offering them outlets for selling jams, pickles, hickory nuts, carvings of wood and deer antlers, quilts, baskets, ceramic pots, wrought iron, herbal salves, soaps, recycled aluminum, poetry slams, bluegrass jams, all kinds of things, all locally sourced, relying on a business model that integrates economy, culture, and ecology. Terry Stevens, who founded Queens Point Coffee in Kaiser, West Virginia, told me that on opening day, he told his employees, "We're not just here to sell coffee, we're changing the culture." And he is less the exception than you might imagine, Tom. What is unfortunately exceptional is the availability of small business loans that could support these establishments, which are gleams in many eyes across the region.
So true. And what you just described really describes a lot of the activity that is happening in Appalachian Kentucky, as a matter of fact. And in that same chapter, Dr. Chambers notes that planning for a tourism-based economy requires the performance of a couple of tasks, and each of these are related to ethnography, the study and the systematic recording of these cultures. So could you kind of expand on what he had to say in that chapter?
Yes, okay. Ethnography. Again, the volume was 30 years ago, and I agree with you that it is still very very timely. But I'd like to turn this into a question about the continuing importance of field-based studies that bring the environmental and social sciences and environmental humanities into conversation about real-world issues. The ethnographic social sciences and humanities are crucial for this, because ethnography is all about recovering the point of view of the culturally other, where culturally includes not only those who speak different languages and live far away, but other professionals. Professions have become so siloed that we can hardly even talk to each other about the same things sometimes. It's the Tower of Babel. I love the graphic experiments of M.C. Escher, which you probably know, especially his tessellations, which violate our need for stable figures and grounds, but serve us well in making us aware of assumptions that might need to change. Ethnographers can also help with tasks of translation that are often needed when you bring together multiple sectors and disciplines for shared inquiry leading to planning for the future of a field site.
Well, let's talk about a potential site and something that's happened in West Virginia that I think is really interesting because it goes to some of the aspirations that we hear about in this area, and that's the implications for an authentic cultural narrative of national park designation. And I'm talking about the recent designation for the New River Gorge in West Virginia. Can this be a kind of a watch what you wish for scenario?
Oh, my goodness. This is a good and quite a fraught question, Tom. The history of national parks is strewn with takings in the West from Native Americans and in the Appalachian region from Native Americans and from settlers. Reprising the deep history of parliamentary enclosures in Great Britain, the Great Smoky Mountain and Shenandoah National Parks were created through clearances of residents. The New River National Park still contains small settlements, but the neighboring communities for whom it was a hunting and fishing ground when it was owned by the coal companies, they experienced the establishment of the park as a form of enclosure. And there's been a good bit of anger over that for decades, fueled by a sense of frustration at having been erased and misrecognized by visitors. So people come for the outdoor adventures, framed as the culmination of the river's contribution to industrial history. But the status of the national park, as opposed to the national river, offers an opportunity to engage the park's neighbors in assessing and realizing opportunities for community development that could be opened up by the new designation. On a subtle level, we might say that national parks function in part to compensate for forms of overdevelopment elsewhere. They provide the kind of open space that urban and suburban developers are accused of destroying. And they've also historically provided a means whereby we are encouraged to inscribe ourselves as national citizens who have, in our travels, visited the parks that stand for who we are as a nation. But the bargain we make was strikingly put to me by a man on Coal River in West Virginia who was very upset about the gating off of coal company lands for mountaintop removal. Imagining that the mountains could be saved by creating a park, he exclaimed, "But people would come to see it for its beauty, but it would be closed to us. My beauty is to hunt and fish. Can tourism address a values gap exposed by such a lament?"
Interesting. What do you think might be accomplished by a region, and let's say we're still talking about Central Appalachia here, by a region that manages to pull itself together onto one page to express its cultural identity? If we were able to do that, what do you think we could accomplish?
One page. Well, I guess it really depends on who is coming up with the identity.
And I know how impossible that is. It's a rhetorical question, I guess.
I've often wondered myself, what is shared throughout the region? Could the shared geological and ecological histories lend themselves to a sense of shared identity among people living in the region? And could such a framework temper the coal and timber-themed industrial identities, which, as we know, are increasingly transient? What alternative politics might we usher in were we to move from carbon-based democracy to phyto or plant-based democracy, where the object of shared stewardship is the commonwealth of mountains, forests, and streams, still giving rise to the world's oldest, most biologically diverse hardwood system? The other focus that could be so interesting would be just fractionated livelihoods. There's just so much. I mean, we think of it as a region where coal and timber provided employment. That's the narrative. But people have always had multiple livelihood strategies. And a wonderful economic anthropologist named Rhoda Halperin wrote a book called The Livelihood of Kin, in which she looks at a system of fractionated livelihoods where people have a wage job, but they've also got the garden, they hunt, they fish, they gather. They share childcare, they share electricity, just all of the kinds of things that people can really put together. Halperin theorizes that this is partly related to living in such a diverse terrain, so that the kinds of things that work against the terrain in public policy, I mean, it's not thought of as an area where you grow things, and yet it has some of the richest soils in the world. In these hollows, but they're in very small places and they're disqualified because they're steep. And then there are the advantages provided by the deepness, which means that, for example, that the berry season can go for a very long time because of the microclimates and so forth. There are a lot of advantages. So these multiple livelihood strategies, it's the kind of thing that is totally overlooked when you look at things like what the salaries are, what are people making, income levels, and that sort of thing. So the bad report cards don't register the significant accomplishments that are really part of cultural heritage.
All right, that's folklorist Mary Hufford, visiting professor of folklore at Ohio State University in Columbus and associate director of LIKEN, the Livelihoods Knowledge Exchange Network in Lexington. Thank you so much, Mary.
You're welcome, Tom. Thank you.
We just heard from folklorist Mary Hufford about shaping interesting, honest regional narratives around culture and how tourism can drive a cleansing of narrative, a Disneyfication of narrative, and how and why that ought to be avoided. Well, joining us now is Jesse Robinson, an Olive Hill native and EKU grad who now heads a creative agency, P&P Creative, located in Mount Sterling. Jesse works to help Eastern Kentucky community organizations shape that narrative that we've been talking about. Thanks for joining us, Jesse.
Thanks so much for having me.
Does Eastern Kentucky have a branding problem?
So often I see the Eastern Kentucky narrative being written as a singular monolith. If we just talk about our history in coal, then that tells the story. Or, you know, the current epidemic with opioids tells the story. But there are so many stories and so many layers to this huge area that I think can add interest and nuance to the stories that are being told and that should be told.
It's a really complicated, complex place, isn't it? And I think people don't understand it necessarily.
Yeah, I agree. And I understand. I mean, probably every region to some extent, people want to try to sum it up in a short kind of glossed over narrative that can be easily sum up a whole group of people. But of course, I take it a little more personal when it's done to our people.
Well, tell us, how are you shaping the story that we tell about ourselves into something that is more constructive and productive? How do you do that while staying true to the realities of the region?
Well, you know, when we work with organizations, we really try to just start with listening. You know, one of the things that I really pride in our process and working with organizations who are also actively working to shift the narrative is that we don't walk into our first meeting with them like we have the answers. We walk in and ask a ton of questions and we listen, and I almost always refuse to slap a generic, you know, squiggly mountain for their logo and call it a day. There's more to Appalachia than our heritage of quilts and canning and mountains. That is an important part. It's a part that I cherish, that is in my bones from, you know, my grandparents and other generations. But there's more layers. And so giving the organizations and the businesses and the people within the communities that we work with the opportunity to talk and tell us what is important to them and maybe even push them a little bit to think past the story that they're always telling, to get into the nuance of their own story, and then just being a conduit to kind of put that out.
Do you think we've had a resistance to telling a polished, professional story about us?
Yeah, I do. I think that we are prideful in a good way, not in a negative way. I think we are humble, and that we don't want to be perceived as trying to prove ourselves to people, whether they're in our region or outside of our region. And maybe sometimes that holds us back a little bit by wanting to, you know, to be comfortable and not make others in our region feel like we're getting above our raisin a little bit.
Well, Mary Hufford, the folklorist, talked about cultural tourism, and we've also on Eastern Standard explored other forms like recreational or ecotourism, agrotourism. But what things do you think need to happen before that level of attention can be focused on our region?
I think whether we're talking about tourism or economic development or community development or even a business development, I think we have to spend some time getting really clear on the goal, and not the goal for next week or next year, but maybe 10 or 20 years from now. And that's not anything new. I mean, I think there's tons of people who think in that way, but we have to be clear about the goal and determine who we're talking to. I think that's also another little missing piece, is that often we're talking to each other, and that's really important. But we have to remember, when we are framing this storytelling and we're framing this branding effort, we also have to frame that conversation with who we are talking to and tie what's important to them back to us and help them see why we are the answer to the relaxing vacation, if it's tourism, the answer to thinking about a new community to invest in a different way. It has to kind of pivot the lens of the conversation a little bit to move past just talking to us and sharing their stories internally.
Jesse, can you give us an example of an organization that you've done this for?
Yeah, we've had a couple of really exciting projects over the past couple of years. We worked most recently with the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky with Jerry Roll and her group. And that project started as a website project and ended up as a full rebrand. So we helped them really get clarity on how they're talking about their organization, because they're doing so much wonderful work. We helped them really make sure that visually they were showing up in a way that matched what they were telling people. For example, in our first meetings with the foundation, over and over and over again, they said, "We're not a normal foundation. We do things differently. We are not normal. You got to think bigger than a normal foundation." And so I finally pushed back and said, "But everything you say and show looks like a normal foundation. You have a tree in your logo like a normal foundation. You're kind of talking in typical foundation language. If we're different, let's be different. And let's make how you are showing up match what you're saying, matching what people experience when they work with you." And that really resonated with them. Another organization that we've worked with is, you know, in that community development space, is we helped Mountain Association, formerly known as MACED, go through a rebrand process. So we worked with them. They've been a partner for several years. And, you know, they kind of had the same thing. Like, we're different. And the way we are showing up and even the way we talk about ourselves, there's a disconnect there. We are not connecting with people. And so what I'm really proud of with both those organizations is that they both work in community work. They both are working to shift the narrative. They're working to help build a new economy. And they have a lot of similarities, but they have a lot of differences. And so those two side by side, I think, are great examples of how two organizations in our region can show up really differently in their brand and in their story, while also kind of communicating similar threads.
Well, Jesse, it's really good to hear from you, because I feel that you represent the very kind of creative and entrepreneurial businesses that we've been talking about hoping to see emerge in this post-coal economy around Eastern Kentucky.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, we're just getting ready to head into year 9. So we've been in business almost a decade now, which is kind of hard to believe. And, you know, I've grown over the past, I'll say 10 years, because I was freelancing pretty heavily in the years leading up to starting the business officially. You know, we've grown to a team of 5, and I'm really proud of that. And I'm constantly trying to recruit people to the region to work with us in one capacity or another. And it's exciting. It's exciting to be growing this business when there were a lot of naysayers in the beginning that said I was a little bit crazy to hang my hat on this region. But I just could not get my heart to go anywhere else.
Well, it's been wonderful to talk with you.
Thanks so much.
Jessica Robinson, she owns P&P Creative in Mount Sterling. And thank you so much, Jesse. Coming up after the break,
we are preparing for our first concert back on stage at the Opera House, Concert with the Stars, on July 31st.
Live entertainment returns to the stages of Central Kentucky.
So we're doing A Midsummer Night's Dream.
What we're going to be looking at is making sure that in our performance activity that we're telling the stories of different cultures and different perspectives and different peoples.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Wendy Barnett with the Undermain Arts Minute, bringing you local and regional arts news and events. The Lexington Philharmonic has announced plans for their 2021-2022 season. The season is titled Stories and is divided into three chapters. The summer chapter features concerts in Lexington Community Food Gardens, the popular Picnic with the Pops at Keeneland, and a strolling concert at Josephine Sculpture Park in Frankfort. The winter chapter includes a concert at the Lyric Theater in Lexington featuring works by Lexington native Julia Perry. The pandemic interrupted search for Lexville's next music director and conductor resumes in the last part of the season with two concerts of full-scale symphonic works conducted by the last two finalists for the position. For more information, go to lexville.org. You can find in-depth writing about Kentucky and the region's arts and culture online at undermain.art. Subscription to Undermain's newsletter can be found on the website. This has been the Undermain Arts Minute for WEKU's Eastern Standard. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
The performing arts, so dependent on gathering large numbers of people in enclosed spaces where they're seated almost elbow to elbow, that all took a direct hit from the restrictions made necessary by the COVID-19 pandemic. We've checked in with three of the region's performing arts organizations to find out how they're now emerging from all of that downtime and lost revenue, and how that downtime has had something of a silver lining, time to step back and think. We'll get started with Central Kentucky's home for the live performance of classical music. The Lexington Philharmonic, Lexphil, has announced its season for 2021-22, and under the leadership of its new interim artistic director, Kelly Corcoran, the focus is on storytelling. Kelly joins us from Nashville, and here in the studio with us is Lexphil Executive Director Allison Kaiser, and thank you both for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Glad to be here.
Allison, let's start with you. First, I know that this has been a very, very rough year, and year and a half, I should say, for your organization. How has Lexphil managed during the pandemic?
Well, I think we managed very well, very creatively, and in a way that was the best way to keep music in our community. We weren't able to do the kind of large-scale concerts that we're primarily known for, but we were able to pivot, and there's that word, of course, but we were able to pivot to doing small ensemble outside work and dove deeply into virtual and video work. So, and, you know, that's something, the video work is something that we're still working to wrap our arms around, but we took advantage of a couple of situations where we did outdoor concerts and turned those into videos. And basically, we were able to, the silver lining in all this is that we were able to do a lot of things that we had wanted to do for several years, but hadn't had the time or the resources to do. So that was, you know, all in all, I think we've come through this well. And the big question is going to be how we reintegrate post-pandemic, if there's going to be such a thing, how we reintegrate and how our audiences respond.
Well, I know that you've mentioned that the pandemic was a challenge that pushed us all to reimagine how we deliver meaning through music, the quote I saw in your release. Is the theme of the new season stories an outcome of that reimagination process?
Yes, it is. I think that a big part of the work that the Philharmonic's been doing over the course of the last 12 months has been our IDEA work, which stands for Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Accessibility. And the orchestral industry is one that's deeply steeped in Eurocentric traditions and music, but that's been changing. And what we're going to be looking at is making sure that in our performance activity that we're telling the stories of different cultures and different perspectives and different peoples, everything from composers of color to female composers to composers from different countries. So we want to make sure that that space is a space that we continue to help our audiences become more comfortable with.
Okay, let's go to Kelly. Kelly Corcoran in Nashville. Kelly is interim artistic director at the Philharmonic. Kelly, tell us what this new season is all about.
I think the title of Stories frames well our hope and our focus for the season in the partners that we're working with, the repertoire that we're focusing on, the way that we're shaping that repertoire and sharing it with our audiences, and the way in which we're curating, you know, all the different venues and places in which we will interact with everyone. So the concept of Stories really came naturally from looking at composers like Julia Perry, who has an incredible story to tell. And she was born in Lexington, to the places we're going. So for example, Seedleaf Gardens, where London Farrell, for example, is one of the gardens we're going to. There's a lot of storytelling there. And even to our musicians in the orchestra, we did a whole virtual connect series during the pandemic where we got to hear from them and hear their stories of, you know, their favorite memories with the orchestra and what they've been doing during this time. So we really wanted to curate a season that created space to hear what our experience has been like today, you know, and how can we continue to listen to all of these stories that exist in our own community and, you know, in the repertoire of the past as well, and how that connects to our lives today.
And I see that you tap into Queen's Gambit in your planning.
Yes. So, of course, Queen's Gambit, the story was based in Lexington. And so that was something we were really eager to try to integrate into our programming. And that led into a really interesting direction where we have a whole program focused on queens. And it includes things like the Haydn Queen Symphony, which was a favorite of Marie Antoinette, a little bit of Queen's Gambit music, but also a little bit of an opera by Duke Ellington that he was working on during his life. He never finished an opera called Queenie Pie. And so we're actually commissioning an orchestral arrangement of excerpts from that unfinished opera by Duke Ellington. So it'll be a fun program focused on music inspired by queens.
Well, I know that partnerships and collaboration have important roles in the plan for this coming season, and I want to talk to both of you about that. So, Kelly, you first. If you would talk to us about these collaborations, the artistic intent, and how the repertoire connects to locations.
Sure. I think that some of that is really direct. So for example, with Seedleaf Gardens, we have some music that is focused on gardening, like make our garden grow, you know. So there's some really overt connections with these partnerships. And it's been really fun to talk with all of these partners and meet with their leadership and have some really robust brainstorming discussions about what would be fun repertoire to do and activities to do and different elements of the experience with each of these partners. So I think each program has organically grown from those relationships with each organization and space. For example, the Lyric Theater is where we will be doing the Julia Perry focused program. And we've had some great conversations with WIT about, of course, the history of the Lyric Theater and how we can tell that story as well through and also along with the story of Julia Perry and focus on her life and legacy in that program. So, and then going back to the Opera House, which is where we'll be doing our Queen program, there will be quite a bit of opera excerpts on that program. And so we're partnering with the UK Opera Theater on that collaborative program. And so there really is kind of a synergy between venue, partners, repertoire, and the other content that we'll be making around the program as well.
Okay, we're going to turn back to Allison Kaiser, who's here in the studio with me. And Allison, how do these new collaborations with artistic partners and venues, how do they connect with your mission, values, and accessibility as an organization?
Excellent question. I want to fly up a little bit from a higher vantage point even than what Kelly's speaking about, because it's not just about the fact that we are partnering with these organizations, but it's even what is changing with us is how we go about that partnership. So it's not about us going to another organization or going to another venue and saying, you know, we want to come do this and this is what we want to do. We go to them and we talk about the concept to see if it fits with their values and their mission and how that it's not just a delivery of a program, but a real sort of melding of the minds to create a program that's going to be not only appealing to our audiences, but trying to understand those audiences that haven't been engaged with the Philharmonic, understanding them from where they are, from where they live, from where they are, from what values they hold, and making sure that we really hear that in how we build the programs and the partnerships.
So everybody gains.
Correct. Everybody gains.
It must have been quite a relief and quite a thrill to send out that press release announcing this new season.
Oh, it certainly was. It's also terrifying, but yes.
Lexville Executive Director Allison Kaiser in the studio with us, and Lexville Interim Artistic Director Kelly Corcoran on the line from Nashville. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find information about the Lexington Philharmonic and the season events calendar online at lexville.org. Another Lexington arts organization that has been navigating the rough waters of the pandemic is the Lexington Theater Company. And here to fill us in on their new season are Artistic Director Lindy Franklin and Outreach Coordinator and Creative Media Designer Joseph Wrightson. Thanks for stopping by Eastern Standard, both of you.
It's so nice to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
So it seems pretty safe to assume that the pandemic hit you all, like all of us, like a ton of bricks. But here you are. You're bouncing back. Are you preparing to return to live in-person performance?
Yes, we are. We are preparing for our first concert back on stage at the Opera House, Concert with the Stars, on July 31st. We're coming back the way we began with our inaugural concert with three amazing Broadway stars, all who have ties to the Lexington, Louisville, and Cincinnati area. So it's very exciting.
And I was talking to Joe before we began the interview, and you were telling me that the rehearsals for this one have been virtual, correct?
Yeah, exactly. They'll be meeting with our music director for some virtual rehearsals before they all come together on the concert day.
You also have announced the release of season two of your online music and storytelling series, Adventures on Casa. Tell us about that.
Well, this was a really special project that Joseph and I had been kind of dreaming about for a while, and really it has been one of those silver linings of the pandemic, because when we looked at what we were going to do last summer, when we weren't able to do our traditional series, Joseph looked at me and said, I think this might be time to launch this bilingual storytelling and music class we've been talking about. And he immediately reached out to one of our other alumni, Nico Acosta Casas, who was in our production of West Side Story. Nico is from Colombia, and Joseph asked him if he would partner in and help write and co-host the series. And it was a huge hit last summer, and so we're bringing it back.
Tell me a little bit about season two. What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so season two, we're really remote because Nico is currently living in Bogota, Colombia right now. So we'll meet on Zoom to film all of our episodes. But season two is full of original songs that we collaborated on together. We talk about different elements of theater and crafting a story, and it's all centralized on what makes our communities so unique. So we do a lot of sharing about, for me, what Lexington is like, and for him, sharing about Bogota and his communities. And it's that sort of creative collaboration that we focus on this season.
Interesting. So are these available on demand?
Yeah, we release a new episode every Tuesday. This summer, we'll release 8 episodes. And once they're released, they're available for any time on our Facebook page and on our YouTube channel.
What would you say viewers can take away from this kind of experience?
I think viewers will be able to be inspired to think creatively about what they can do at home or anywhere with anyone in terms of the arts. There's a lot of creative activities that we throw at the kids. We give a lot of challenges. So our main goal is that you can take the arts with you wherever you go.
Well, Lindy, Concert with the Stars is coming up. What about beyond that? What do you have planned for the rest of the season?
Yes. Well, we are so excited because, as I said, there have been some silver linings in this pandemic. And while we weren't able to produce in 2020 and a lot of 2021, we have been developing our education and outreach arms of the company and really growing the company in a new way. So what we're looking forward to is coming into this next season, putting all of the pieces of the puzzle together. So our producing in-person arm will be coming back alongside our education and our outreach programs. So we're anticipating a full return in 2022. We'll have our Concert with the Stars in January, 2 main stage summer musicals, and our fall script to table event. But alongside of that, we have our new artist development program, which is an online education program for third graders through professionals. That's happening September through May. And we also have a free summer workshop in the ADP happening leading up to Concert with the Stars. And we also have Story Cycle, which is another outreach program, sort of a sister program almost to Adventures in CASA in our outreach department. And that is also happening during our school year as well. So it's been really amazing to have this time to sort of birth these new programs and get them on their feet. And now we're excited to see how they will all intertwine to really fully live the mission of the Lexington Theater Company, which is creating professional theater and training the next generation of theater artists so that our communities can enjoy a shared experience of masterful storytelling.
My gosh, you all have been busy. And I think for anybody who's coming into this for the first time, anybody maybe new to the area, is not familiar with the Lex, it's always important to talk about the original mission, which I think is fascinating and very unique. Could you expand on that for just a moment?
Absolutely. Well, we've always had these two sort of side-by-side goals, creating first-rate, fabulous professional theater for Lexington and Central Kentucky to enjoy. But our mission is really deeply rooted in education and in training not just the next generation of theater professionals, but also with some of our outreach programs that we've developing. It's really about discovering the artist in all of us and tapping into the creativity that we all have inside. And whether our students and participants in our outreach programs or our patrons, you know, go on to do more professional work, or whether they become teachers, parents, doctors, whatever they decide to do. You know, having this artistic exposure at such a young age with a program like Adventures in CASA and in our efforts to reach as many people as we possibly can, we're just hoping to be the tie that binds our community and bring us all together. The arts are so important to our humanity. They're so important to moving forward as a community. And so we're really thrilled to see, you know, how we can be a positive force, not just here, but as far around the world as we can.
Joseph, I see wheels turning over there.
Oh, no, I'm just, every time I hear Lindy talk about the mission, it just makes me so excited to be a part of the Lex. And I feel like we're doing so many exciting things.
Lexington Theater Company Artistic Director Lindy Franklin and Outreach Coordinator and Creative Media Designer Joseph Wrightson. Thank you both so much.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
You can hear Lindy and Joseph each week on the podcast Beyond the Fourth Wall, produced by the Lexington Theater Company. This 30-minute show is a series of discussions with creatives, entrepreneurs, and theatrical artists on how the skills cultivated in the theater translate to all industries. Beyond the Fourth Wall is available on Apple, Google, and Spotify podcasts, as well as Simplecast. After a year in lockdown, the Appalachian Shakespeare Center here at Eastern Kentucky University is getting ready to return to the stage with their annual Shakespeare in the Ravine production. Joining us now is Center Director Matt Johnson. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So you had to skip the 2020 production due to COVID. Is that correct?
Well, we did have to skip doing a live production. So what we ended up doing was doing a full-length puppet film of Twelfth Night.
Okay. And you're returning to staging the show in what's known on the EKU campus as The Ravine. And for those who are not familiar, tell us about that setting.
The Ravine is really at the heart of campus. There's a big green space. It's a huge bowl full of trees and grass and God's beauty right in the center of campus. And in the middle of that bowl is an amphitheater that has a large stage. There's no real lights to speak of, so all of our shows tend to be in as light is dimming it toward the end of the day. And it's a large space big enough for people to come and bring picnics and enjoy this very natural beauty that we have at EKU. And it could seat a couple thousand people probably.
Wow. And so the technology of it sounds very, very fundamental with no lighting, no sound, I assume, too?
We do have some sound reinforcement. We tend to use microphones to help the projection. It is a natural bowl, so the acoustics are pretty good out there. Uh-huh. I can do it without a mic. Not all of our cast can.
Which work of Shakespeare will be this year's production?
So we're doing A Midsummer Night's Dream, and it is going to be a big, fun time for the whole family. We tend to do we usually cut our shows about in half, so they usually run about 90 minutes to 2 hours.
And I know that there's something very unique about the way that you're going about this production, if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, so when we did, like I said, Twelfth Night with puppets over in the last year when we couldn't perform outside. So this year, it's something that I've been wanting to do for a while, is do Midsummer Night's Dream and use puppets for all of the fairies. So in the plot, the couple of pairs of lovers run out into the woods and they're run smack dab into the middle of this marriage spat between the king and the queen of the fairies. And there's a whole bunch of fairies in the show. And using the size of the ravine, we're making not just small puppets, but some pretty big puppets. Some of them are 15 feet tall. So they tend to be mostly body puppets and some hand and rod puppets.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, and we're talking about, as you say, large-scale puppetry, and there have to be a lot of challenges in that for both the actors and for the stage production itself. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a big undertaking for us as a small company. Since we normally do the show in Lexington as well, but with the COVID restrictions, we couldn't quite fit that into the planning. So we usually open in June and then bring it to the Ravine in July, which gave us a little bit more lead time to do something this large. We're still feverishly working on these puppets. That's happening downtown downstairs as I talk to you. So it's given us more time to be able to build this stuff that we normally wouldn't be able to. And the actors, it gives us another week of rehearsal for them to be able to learn a new skill with puppetry. It's very much like acting, but it's much more technical. I would say it's closer to a dance, as much rehearsal as it takes.
Does it add an additional layer to the rehearsal process?
Yes, I would say we add time in a few days just playing with the puppets and getting to know them. And then as they rehearse with the puppets, and invariably some of them break and we have to have some. So we essentially lose an actor when one of the puppets goes down and we have to repair them. But it is a whole nother learning process for the actors. It's not just their voice and body, but their body becomes much larger. And then they have to work together to kind of form. Some of these puppets take three people to manipulate.
So I know that the summer production of Shakespeare in the Ravine is only just one of the center's functions. What else do you offer?
Our mission at the Appalachian Shakespeare Center is to promote agency and citizenship through the works of William Shakespeare. So our centerpiece is an educational outreach project called the Loose Cannon Project, where we work with schools in our service region and beyond. And we'll send our Shakespearean actors into the school to work on projects with the students based on different plays. And then they work all semester, usually in the spring, and then they bring those projects to EKU for a festival where we have other theatrical workshops for them and kind of have a day-long festival. And we also do summer camp, which we're doing right now, Shakespeare summer camp. And we're planning on having our inaugural winter production this coming January.
Okay, back to Shakespeare in the Ravine. What are the dates of the production?
So we run Tuesday, Friday, and Saturday, the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th, and the 29th, 30th, and 31st, the last 2 weeks of July. It's at 7:30, and it's free to everybody.
No admission fee?
None at all. We will ask for donations, but it's always free in the Ravine.
All right. That's Matthew Johnson, director of the Appalachian Shakespeare Center here at EKU. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you so much, Tom.
More information about Shakespeare in the Ravine and the EKU Theater program can be found online at ekutheater.com, and that's T-H-E-A-T-R-E. Before we go, a note about next week's edition of Eastern Standard. A new book by Kentuckians reminds us that we can enrich our lives by enriching those of others. By Jack and Angene Wilson, it's about the Peace Corps.
We were college seniors. We were trying to figure out what we were going to do with the rest of our lives. We were planning on getting married. We wanted to be useful to other people. But we also had an idea of travel and maybe a little bit of adventure. And we'd heard Kennedy's inaugural where he said, ask not what your country
can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
The book, Voices from the Peace Corps, is based on interviews with more than 100 Kentuckians who joined the Corps.
Their stories, I believe, should be heard and seen, and their experiences shared.
People like Tara Lloyd of Mount Sterling.
I had met a lot of people who said they always wished they'd joined the Peace Corps, and I guess my fear was that 10 or 20 years down the road, I'd be saying the same thing, that I should just go while I had the nerve to go.
Getting out there and doing good works where it's needed and appreciated. Next week here on Eastern Standard. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage is our executive producer, Wendy Barnett, producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on air, online, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest a topic or an interview? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.